end of the world is nigh. A cataclysm is coming, and Azeroth will never be the same again. This is a final voyage through the old world. And these are the many wonders you'll see.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Postcards from the Old World, our last great pre-cataclysmic tour of the old world of Azeroth before their imminent alteration mere weeks from now in the new expansion. I'm Arezzo.
And I'm Crashing.
And Crashing is with me again as part of our revolving cast of presenters in these last few episodes. And today we're going to be talking about three zones in southern Kalimdor. We're going to be talking about Tanaris, Un'Goro Crater and Silithus, not only from our own points of view, but with the contributions of some of our guildies from the Alia Iacta Est Guild, who've been contributing on our forums, as always, and we'll be sharing their thoughts on these zones in a little while. To start with, we're going to change things around a little bit in today's show. Beira's regular contribution from the Alliance point of view on these zones is a little bit more of a taster for these zones this time around, since the Alliance and Horde questing experiences are really very similar in these parts of the world. So this is going to serve as a little introduction to these zones. Take it away, Beira.
The War of the Shifting Sands played out across the deserts of southern Kalimdor. The old god C'Thun had taken some of the semi-sentient insects known as the Silithids and created the Akir to prepare Azeroth for his return. In An'Kiraj, their forces made ready to purge the land of all non-insect life. But weak as the races of Azeroth were, the Kiraji did not reckon on the combined power of the Night Elves and the Bronze Dragonflight. At first, the Night Elves stood alone against An'Kiraj. Fandral Staghelm led his armies against wave upon wave of General Rajax's Silithid warriors. Just when it seemed that they might gain ground, Staghelm found that he had fallen into a trap. His own son Volsten was captured by the Kiraji forces, and General Rajax took Volsten and brought him before the Night Elf front lines and rent his living body asunder before the eyes of his father. Demoralized, the Night Elves fell back into An'Goro Crater and to the very borders of Tanaris. But in An'Goro, the lingering presence of the Titans brought some mysterious power to bear. The Akir could not take the land, and the Night Elves advanced again, pushing the Kiraji armies back to Silithus. The Bronze Dragonflight also offered its aid, having found that the Silithids would go so far as to try to invade the Caverns of Time. The combined Night Elf and Dragon forces routed the Akir, forcing them back into An'Kiraj. Three brave bronze dragons pursued the Kiraji forces into the city, giving their lives so that Anachronos would have time to seal the Kiraji in. Anachronos forged the means to protect Kalimdor from further assault, while still providing a path into the city someday when the forces of Azeroth would be ready to enter and annihilate the Kiraji Empire for once and for all. But when Anachronos gave the Scepter of the Shifting Sands the key to this entrance to Fandral Staghelm, the druid shattered the scepter in his grief and rage over the loss of his son. Eventually the scepter would be reassembled, and the gates of An'Kiraj reopened, and the many races of Azeroth would set aside their differences and band together at Cenarion Hold to join in the assault. High above, bronze dragons still circle over Staghelm Point, and the shades of fallen druids and sentinels prowl the ruins of Shadowmoon, waiting and watching.
Okay, thank you as always, Beira. It's interesting, looking at these zones kind of as a group, I think. There are certain things that kind of continue, you know, carry on through them. There's a sort of thread through these zones, and there's almost a kind of, I mean, the progression that a lot of people follow is very clearly, you know, from one to the next to the next.
Yeah, it's literally an east to west line where you go, and as you level, you go from one zone to the next zone to the next zone. Especially in the later zones, Syphilis is probably one of those zones that falls into that category for players now, where you don't actually, you can skip it entirely if you want to, because you out level, you know, you can get to Outland before you actually get to the, you know, the late 50s where you would normally go there. But if there's one thing that kind of ties all the zones together, and Eldekar on the boards pointed this out, it's bugs. It's like bugs of increasing difficulty and horror. You know, basically as you go along, there's some bugs in Tanaris, and they're kind of, you know, they're kind of scary. And then Un'Goro has bugs, a little bit bigger bugs. You know, there's those kind of nasty alien-looking bug cave things that you go into. And then when you get to Syphilis, it's the buzzing constantly and swarms flying overhead and everything else. So if you have a fear of bugs, I think this is probably the last group of zones that you want to do.
Yeah, totally. And yeah, as Eldekar did point out, I mean, in capital letters, you know, bugs. This is the thing these zones have together. And a few people talked about the kind of the intense creepiness of those bug areas that you know, where you have to go underground into their hives. And the weird alien nature of the walls and the textures around you, and the fact that all those insects just look increasingly unpleasant as you go, and all the kind of the strange pulsing, you know, kind of almost like egg sac kind of things,
yeah,
that hang from the ceilings. And I remember, like a lot of people, I'm sure, I remember the first time I went into one of those areas on a quest, just thinking, this is just wrong.
I think it's a testimony as to how good Blizzard is at world building, because they've basically built this entire world, which looked at from one standpoint is alien. I mean, I play a troll, you know, you run around killing monsters and such. But they've done such a good job at creating this world that when you get to those bug parts, it feels alien, like another step alien away from what you're already doing. They managed to immerse you in their world to such an extent that when you get there, it is almost like nauseating in a way. It's, yeah, like this kind of weird, nauseating, creepy, mm, alien feeling. You feel like this is not of this world.
Yes.
So,
you're right, actually. Shudder. That sense of being able to spot something that doesn't belong in an imaginary world.
Exactly, yeah.
Is quite impressive. It's not the sort of thing that you necessarily think about when you're there, but when you actually analyze what's going through your brain at that point, yeah, you're right. You're in a world that doesn't really exist. It only exists on the screen. The rules that determine what works and what doesn't work in it are, you know, they're artificial ones. They're made up as Blizzard wanted them to be. So realistically, anything could happen, and in a lot of places, anything does. And yet, there's still something that they've managed to convey that wrongness about. You're right. That's very impressive. And it's only kind of now that I'm really thinking through that I'm realizing how impressive it actually is.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
This Blizzard company, it may go places.
Yeah, I know. We should probably keep an eye on them.
Sure.
So let's get into some detail. We can work through those zones progressively. We're going to start with Tanaris. As always, we're going to have a little intro to each of the zones as we go. This time, Gafoni is back reading those in for us. So first of all, we're going to take a little more detailed look at Tanaris. Or, if you're Beira, Tanaris.
Under the powerful desert sun, the sandy wastes of Tanaris stretch, apparently endlessly, before the visiting traveller. This is a perilous land of harsh conditions, and local inhabitants, whether humanoid or beast, reflect that harshness. Scorpids and basilisks roam the land, pirates prey on the unwary from their fortified base on the coast, and tribes of ogres and the Waste Wander Bandit clan hold fast around the scattered oases and desert ruins. The edges of the region hide the troll complex of Zul'Farak and, so legend has it, the entrance to the fabled land of Uldum. By the northern approach to the region, the goblin town of Gadgetzan stands alone in the desert, from which a new and alien threat has begun to emerge.
So, Tanaris, yet another desert. You know, we have had our share of kind of parched earth,
territories as we've gone around the world, but actually this feels like, you know, a bit more like you kind of the desert that you expect it to be. This is a big open sandy waste with dunes, and, you know, kind of the odd oasis, which, you know, again is one of those things that proper deserts should have. One feels that, you know, you should be able to come across little patches of palm trees and stuff in random spots in a desert. But it is very open. It is very kind of sand duney. It's got a real sense, I think, of expansiveness. You know, we've hit a few zones in the last few shows, you know, where the jungle zones, for instance, where, you know, everything's kind of been very closed in, and there's been all that sort of sense of not knowing what's around the next corner. Well, here's a zone where there are no corners, pretty much. It's just you know, as far as the eye can see, it's the desert, it's the dunes, it's scorpions and ogres and all that kind of stuff. So it does have that feel, I think, of being in the same way as I think Stranglethorn felt like a proper jungle, and, you know, Feralas felt like a proper ancient forest. This feels like a proper desert. I think that's my take on it anyway.
Yeah, I think I agree. I mean, honestly, after praising Blizzard for their world building, you know, a minute and a half ago, I'm not a huge fan of the desolate desert zones especially in the old world. They just never clicked for me, but this one does. You're right. Whereas, you know, some of the more, I just think of them as the red zones. There's that stretch of red zones right there. And, you know, they kind of are boring. This manages to be empty, but at the same time, you know, there's lots of stuff going on. It feels like a real place. It feels like a real desert.
Yeah.
And I enjoy it a lot more than I do the desolate type zones.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, compared to somewhere like, you know, the desolate Desolus.
Right.
Which we talked about it when we were in those zones on the show. You know, it does feel like one of those, I don't know, it just feels bleak and whatever. But this Tenaris does have that sense of not being bleak so much as it just feels expansive, I think is the word I used earlier. It feels like it's almost, although there's not a lot to see, because it's so big and so open, it sort of feels a little bit like there might be just something, you know, interesting just over the horizon.
Right, yeah, it's barren, not to be confused with the Barrens, which is not particularly barren, but it's barren, but it's not boring.
No.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the other more desolate type zones, not including Desolus, they're just kind of boring, to be honest with you. I feel like they're space fillers in a lot of ways, whereas this zone seems to have a real purpose in the story and in the world and everything else. So I like this zone.
Yeah, I do too. It's not kind of absolutely one of my favorites, but it's one that I do enjoy having a good run around when I'm leveling at an appropriate point. It's got, you know, it the other thing that's worth noting about it, I think, is that although everyone thinks it's just the desert, there is more interesting stuff, and I say more visually interesting stuff than just the desert. You know, there over on the coast, there's a lot going on. There's all the pirates in Lostriga Cove, and, you know, all that kind of stretch of the coastline there is quite busy, and it doesn't necessarily feel because you go through the cave to get to the cove, and there are buildings, and there's the kind of cliffs that hem it in on the landward side. It doesn't have that kind of same expansive nature about it, but it does feel very much like it's a, you know, a little complex. It's one of those the places, like we've talked about previously, that, you know, it feels like almost like a mini dungeon. You know,
yeah,
you
it go feels like a real place.
Tunnel. Yeah, you go in through the tunnel and you start to kind of find the pirates that are there, and then you get a little bit further in, and then you kind of find, you know, where they've built the base and the ships and stuff like that. And it's got a bit of a sense of progression through it, which I think the quests that take you there tend to help as well, because, you know, there is that sense of, right, we'll start with the easy things and then we'll go back and we'll kill the harder things and so on. So there's that. Down in the south, you know, things get a little bit, start to get a bit weird with all the thistle shrub area, which is, you know, kind of got all the weird elemental monsters walking around, and that kind of the landscape changes completely. There are, you know, again, ruins that have been almost taken over by the sand and by the desert, scattered all around the place. So
giant,
you know,
skeletons, which I love.
Yeah,
you know, you run into the desert and there'd just be a gigantic, you know, skeleton of something.
Yeah, absolutely. And you never know, you know, what was that? And obviously, that, you know, all of that kind of creates this very evocative sense of that kind of lost worldy sort of thing that, you know, that actually moving on to Un'Goro will become very much part of the kind of the mythology almost. So there are plenty of things going on, and obviously, in a completely different kind of sense, there's the Caverns of Time, which, although they look very much like they fit into the zone, you know, very much they are. They're a gateway to instances and stuff that don't really relate to Tanaris. So there are things within the zone that kind of break up. I won't even say break up monotony, because I don't think it's monotonous, but break up that sense of it all being this kind of flat, you know, duney space. So it's, I think there is much more variety in the zone than I think is necessarily immediately obvious.
Oh, I agree totally. And you have one of the better neutral cities too.
Yeah, I was actually my next thing I was going to talk about was going to be Gadgetzan, which I think is a brilliant little town.
It feels very
right for the zone. It feels like a little desert town. I mean, actually, somebody, in fact, it was Tandoro in the thread, referred to it. In talking about it, he said Mos Eisley for the win.
Exactly, and I never made that connection before, but that's exactly what it feels like. It's really
absolutely
funny.
And actually, even I mean, there's a lot of that kind of little Star Warsy vibe to it, because there's also, you know, the giant skeletons in the desert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Exactly. When I was talking about the giant skeletons, yeah. I was going to say just like in Star Wars.
Yeah, just like on Tatooine. And so I think that's, I don't know how deliberate that is, but I do think that you're right, that, you know, that he's right. And I think the sense of Gadgetzan is as Mos Eisley is a bit spot on.
I think it's completely deliberate, honestly, especially when we get in the next zone, which is pretty much like the pop culture zone, is how I think of it. I think whoever designed this zone, I wonder if they did a couple of them, because there's a lot of pop cultural stuff, and I think the Tatooine comparison is spot on. I think that's probably what they were going for. But
yeah. Since I started mentioning something that somebody said on the thread, let's have a quick look at stuff here. So I mentioned Tandoro. So Tandoro's whole comment was, Tanaris is lots of fun for the most part, neat quests and plenty of space, and the most goblin-y goblin town in vanilla. Velvet said, Tanaris is gorgeous for a desert, in my opinion. It has very pale sand dunes that contrast highly with a very dark sky no matter the time of day. Its bright blue coastal waters rival those of Stranglethorn Vale. If it weren't a desert, I could see it being an in-game vacation destination, which I've got
even being a desert, honestly.
Sort of seeing. The giant skeletons make me wish I could see the massive living creatures they must have come from. So that again ties in with what we were just saying. He does talk a bit further on about one of the quests in the zone, which we'll come to when we talk a bit more about questing. Lachesis, who starts out by saying, yes, another desert zone. Good Lord, these places are boring. does point out that there are a few things that he likes about the zone. One is how much world PvP seems to happen there. The second is the Caverns of Time, which is obviously, as I mentioned, a kind of specific part of the zone that was kind of added in. The third redeeming feature, this is, to quote him, in my humble opinion, is Zul'Farak, specifically the Temple Steps battle. More specifically, the Temple Steps battle 3 or 4 years ago, when people didn't have heirlooms and didn't have the Wrath AoE it down ASAP mentality. That fight used to be really tough. The whole place was dynamic and interesting, but the first time I stood on top of those steps and watched the crowd spawn below me and realized we'd have to fight all of them, I nearly crapped myself. I will never forget that moment, nor the rush of actually making it through in one piece.
Well, I will tell you that even 3 or 4 years on, when people do have heirloom gear and have the Wrath, you know, AoE all down as soon as possible, it's still, when I was leveling, I still wiped 2 or 3 times on that fight. Just if people aren't familiar with what we're talking about, yeah. Zul'Farak is an instance. I think it's a mid the 40s instance.
Sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, and 42 to 46 ish, and it's basically it's sand trolls. So you've got the Aztec type architecture that you have with all your other troll stuff, but it's in the middle of the desert, and it's open, so you can like ride mounts and things like that. It's like a city basically in the middle of the zone. And the stairs fight is you there's a gigantic temple in the middle of the zone, and I forget how you trigger it, but you do something up top to trigger it, and all of a sudden down at the bottom of the stairs of the temple are, it seems like, hundreds. I don't know how many it is. It's a lot.
it is a lot, definitely.
Yeah, I would bet it's 40 or so. All of a sudden, aggro mobs that are coming right at you, and if you're not ready for it, which the first time I was there. I think one person in the pickup group had ever been in the zone, and they didn't warn anybody that this was going to happen. And it was the tank, and he started the quest, And he started the instant or the script and ran down the bottom of the stairs. And we're all kind of standing there looking at him like, where in the hell is this guy going? And he was dead in a minute, and the rest of us were dead shortly after. So, yeah, it can still take you by surprise. And it's still, even, you know, if you're not ready for it,
it's still
a fun fight. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, Velvet, one of the other things that Velvet mentioned was Zolfarak generally, and specifically said, I absolutely love doing Zolfarak with people who've never been there, simply to see their reactions to the massive spawns at the bottom of the stairs. It's one of the few places that gets pugs talking to each other these days.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
Sorry.
That's exactly true. If you're not, and like I said, if you're not ready for it, it'll overwhelm you quick. And I suspect it's one of those zones too where people there's a lot of runners.
Yeah.
So even if you're a little bit above level, I suspect you got to be really careful because, you know, it's a twisty type dungeon. So you know, when you let one get away, he'll run off and bring back 50 of his friends, and you'll have a stair fight without the stairs again because it's a densely packed in terms of of mobs.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's a good instance. A lot of fun.
Yes, I mean, I like Zolfarak a lot. In fact, as I was leveling Bachi, my priest that I started for this project, I ended up healing Zolfarak in a random pug and had pretty much that experience. I mean, I did know what was coming, and the tank clearly did, but a couple of people in the group didn't, and so the tank was trying to explain, and in the end the tank just said, oh, you know what, let's just do it. And you interact with one of the prisoners in the cages at the top of the...
That's what it is, right.
Off, yeah. And then these things just started coming, and it got quite hairy. I will confess, you know, even though I was there in my heirloom gear, at a reasonable level for doing the zone, doing the instance, it was quite tough once groups started coming in and people started kind of getting a little bit away from our group. And so there is a lot of truth in what people say about the particular that particular part of Zolfarak. There's obviously loads more of Zolfarak that's also a lot of fun to do.
Right.
I think it's a great instance, actually.
I expect too, it was a good training instance back in vanilla when you were kind of getting ready to start maybe thinking about doing, you know, raids and such. Because, I mean, that fight, for example, if you don't do aggro management in that fight, I mean, it's over. You know, that's barely, even in heirloom gear, it's over pretty quickly. I suspect that the zone itself is pretty good training or was pretty good training at the time for, you know, bigger fights and more complex fights and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think as an instance, it's quite unusual. It's an outdoor instance. You know, you can mount in it, which even in a lot of instances that appear to be outdoors, actually you can't do that in them. Whereas, you know, this is one that very specifically it's kind of all out in the open. It feels like it covers a huge geographical area. And there's lots of different kind of things, you know, there's all those areas with all the loads of little scarabs scuttling around on the ground, which when you first see them, you have a moment. It's like, ooh, there's a lot of those. And fair enough, you know, they're not going to aggro and you can manage around them unless somebody goes berserk with AOE, in which case it can get quite messy. But, you know,
which people always do now.
Yeah, exactly. it is one of those places where you can experience lots of different kinds of encounter, and it's actually quite easy to get lost in as well because it is so big, and because one or two of the kind of the boss fights are off in a corner somewhere or off around away from the what looks like a kind of logical path through it. It's quite easy to go astray in there. As far as the rest of Tanaris is concerned, there are a lot of things going on in it, as I said earlier, and although a certain number of the quests tend to be a little bit of the usual, you know, go and kill X number of those and bring back Y number of these quests, like, you know, waste wonder water pouches, how many of those have I picked up over the years, but there are also some, you know, slightly unusual ones. There's the wonderful quest to pick up the bits of Gazridian that are buried all over the zone that you have to wear the special helmet to be able to detect on your mini-map.
To be able to see them, yeah. I think your definition of wonderful is slightly different than mine.
Well,
it is fun.
It is fun. It's fun because I think mostly because of the crazy helmet.
The hat.
Exactly. But it's also, you know, I think the last time you and I were doing one of these shows, we were talking about the kind of quests that you can just pick up and and just do them as a sort of, you know, as a kind of an ongoing thing as you do other quests.
While you're doing other things, right.
And I think that's a good example of one of those, because strictly speaking, you know, whether you're wearing the helmet or not, the helmet will help you spot these things on your mini-map, but you can spot where the ground is, you know, is kind of, has got that, the appropriate shape to it, the appropriate thing that you can interact with. So you can quite happily, you don't have to wear the helmet, you can wear whatever your normal, you know, head armor is, and you can carry on questing and you can spot these things as you go around. And there are, I can't remember how many of those pieces it is to pick up, but it's a lot. It's like 40 of them, I think, maybe 30, but you do have to find quite a few of them. So it is definitely one of those quests that you can just pick up and then keep on, you know, kind of picking the items up for as you go around the entire zone. So I think it's wonderful is perhaps too strong a word, but it's got that sense of, you know, well, it gives you something to do even while you're just, you know, crossing the wilderness between one area that you've been questing in and the next area that you know your next quest is taking you to.
It's a good zone for a herbalist too, or herbalist, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on.
Yes, both of those things.
Yeah. Because you can see the stuff. Like you said, it's kind of the wide open area. You can see the, and there's not a lot of ground cover, so you can see the stuff glittering out in the distance.
Yes, it's probably where I got most of my Fire Bloom, and probably, I think, I want to say Sungrass. I could be wrong, but certainly Fire Bloom. If I ever need any for any bizarre reason, or if I'm at a point where I'm leveling a herbalist and I need to, you know, it's one of those hump areas in the profession progression. Fire Bloom. Oh yeah, if it's Fire Bloom, that's where I need to go. And yes, it's kind of a lot. In fact, this and Angoro between them are quite well known for that kind of gathering sort of stuff. You know, Angoro more so. I think everyone's got a view of Angoro as a place to go for minerals, but again, for herbs as well, you can do quite well out of it. But
Tanaris too. The minerals. Any of those creepy bug caves we're talking about before are excellent for mining.
Yes, if you can face the,
if you can
horror.
Stand it,
exactly.
Right.
Otherwise, like we mentioned, Lostriger Cove and the freebooters, the South Sea freebooters and pirates there, which, in the same way, I think as we talked about Booty Bay and the Blood Sail Buccaneers, you know, this is another one of those. These feel like proper pirates. They've got the outfits. They've got the pirate treasure map. You know, one of those things is like you can pick up the pieces of the pirate treasure map there and have to work out where it refers to so that you can go and try and retrieve their treasure. That's a great little
thing. That's a great quest, yeah.
Absolutely. Especially because you actually, I mean, fair enough, now I assume the way it works is once you've put the map together and you pick up the quest that's associated with it, I'm going to guess that that your zone map will now indicate, you know, a question mark or whatever is where you need to go, which is a bit unfortunate because actually you used to have to work it out.
You had to actually look at the in-game map and say, okay, what does this look like?
It's because the description on the map is on the document that you put together is not that clear, and it didn't used to just highlight everything on the map. So working out that it was on, you know, that you needed to go to that bit of beach that you can only really get to by swimming around to it, and that used to be an actual challenge. And now, like I say, I assume, I could be wrong, but I'm going to assume that when you pick up that quest and then you look at your map, it's going to tell you exactly where you need to go, which is kind of unfortunate. But yeah, things like that, I think, give a bit of flavor to the zone. You know, the pirates kind of add a slightly different kind of texture anyway, and then having a treasure map to bury treasure, again, it's just that extra little bit of a zing to the zone. And then, you know, yes, you do start to encounter the Silithids. And you do have, you know, the first, I mean, there's one, the Writhing Deep in Ferelas, is, you know, the start of this kind of underground hive setup in the game, but it's not as extensive as you start to get in these few zones. And Tanaris is the first place that you're gonna really run across one of those that is as extensive as it is. That's got all the stuff going on above ground, and of course, because a lot of them have multiple ways in, and they're quite, you know, on lots of different levels, trying to find the thing that you're looking for when you're questing in the zone, you can have to spend quite a lot of time in those things, and they are quite dangerous. There's a lot of stuff crawling and flying and just generally threatening in all of those hives, that especially when this is the first time that you've really encountered them, you don't know what the specifics of this particular kind of monster or that kind of monster are going to be. The ones that have lots of, you know, a little bunch of little ones trailing around in their wake. It's like, okay.
Oh, when you kill them and then they spawn little ones after you kill them.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, I killed it. And oh, no.
Yeah. Or or the, you know, the flying ones that manage somehow as you're killing them to some, you know, to kind of call out to another flying one that, as far as you were concerned, was miles away. And suddenly screaming in to, you know, to jab you with its stinger. They are, those areas, those parts of this zone and the next two, I think are amazingly atmospheric. And you know, all of that storyline about something is entering the world and it's something that's not very, very nice or very good, is very effectively done, I think, through these zones.
I agree. And you can't avoid it either. I mean, even, well, to go to the next zone we were talking about, you almost have to walk right through the Noxious Lair, I think it's called. It's one big area. Yeah, I mean, you can skirt it if you know it's there, but if you're running around trying to find the next zone over in Goro, first of all, it's hard to find a little bit, and you come around a dune, basically, and over a little ridge, and all of a sudden there's this big grasping, they look like claw things sticking out of the ground, and you're right, it takes you aback the first time you see it. It really does.
And the very first time I remember seeing one, You know those kind of big claw leg things that come out of the ground, and the way they just slightly twitch?
Twitch, yeah.
That freaked me out. That was this really can't be good. Because, you know, you're not used to the landscape moving like that.
Yeah.
I mean, even, you know, given the way that the kind of the game, you know, the graphics in the game work, generally speaking, you don't see trees moving in the breeze. You don't see, you know, now actually, obviously, as part of the kind of the graphic upgrades that seem to have come in with patch 4.0.1, there's that sense that kind of the ground cover, you know, kind of the grass moves a little bit and stuff like that. So that's kind of moved on. But certainly the first time in vanilla days, you'd see one of these silithid incursions and you saw that twitchy leg thing going on. That was really creepy. In fact, Eldekar said, when he was making his point about what do Ngoro, Silithus and Tanaris have in common, bugs, his comment is, "I remember the first time I went down into one of these holes to fight bugs. It was the first time I truly freaked out in WoW, face to face with one of these ugly creatures. I still don't think I'm quite used to it." And actually, I don't think in all the, you know, all the stuff that's been added to the game in two expansions since then, even those kind of the Nerubian bugs and stuff that are in various places, I don't think anything is quite as creepy and unnerving and skin crawly as ferreting around in one of those underground hives.
Yeah, there's something about it that's very unsettling. It really is. I wasn't kidding about the nausea thing. It's kind of gets that little thing going in your stomach where it just doesn't, you know, when you see something that isn't right.
Yeah.
You see, it happens in real life too. You see it, it just doesn't right and makes you a little nauseous. They did an excellent job. So.
Yeah. Anything else that you'd like to add to our little tour of Tanaris?
No, I think we're ready to move on to Ngoro.
Which is one of those things that, you know, as zone progressions lead you to do, it definitely leads you there. You know, like you said about these zones, there is a path. In fact, if you think about Ngoro, there is one path in and one path out. If you follow the kind of the logical progression, it's like, well, this is clearly a zone where I just, you know, I come in at one end, I do a bunch of stuff, I go out the other. So the move from Tanaris into Ngoro Crater is a very logical one. And before we move on, I did say earlier on we were going to talk about a couple of the quests. I've talked about the Gazridian one, but the other one that several people mentioned on the thread is that poor tortoise.
The turtle that walks at turtle speed, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the one. Eldekar mentioned things that I don't miss from these zones. The incredibly long tortoise escort quest across Tanaris. The quest that I mentioned that Velvet had mentioned. Good lord. One of the longest, most annoying escort quests in the game has you escort a turtle named Tuga from the southwest corner of the zone all the way to the northeastern beach to his wife. You have plenty of time to do so, but as you can imagine, the turtle moves quite slowly. Not as slowly as walking speed escort NPCs, but frustratingly slower than even a 60% mount. He also frequently gets aggroed by the many creatures roaming the desert, even if you're high level, and take extra care to try and maneuver through them so he doesn't. With that said, it's worth the trouble just to see his dialogue during and when you reach Torta, his wife. Which is one of those brilliant encounters, which is almost kind of like, where on earth have you been? when he finally is reunited with her. But that is a terrible quest.
I think it's saying something when someone describes it as the worst of the escort quests. It's like, well, none of them are particularly great.
Absolutely. In fact, on the last show, Beira described the one in Swamp of Sorrows as the worst escort quest in the world. So clearly, everyone's got their own particular worst. But I do think that's bad because it takes so long. It's not necessarily bad because of the totally suicidal nature of the escort or escortee, which makes some of the escort quests bad. It's just that it is literally from one corner of the zone to the diagonally opposite corner of the zone, straight through the middle. And actually, the other thing that, you know, is in Tenaris has is it's another one of those mechanical chicken escort quests. And as we've talked about in previous shows,
I didn't remember that.
This is the third of them. And as we've talked about in the other zones, somewhere along the line, I forget which patch it was in, that quest became much shorter. They made it so that you don't have to take the chicken so far, and it doesn't necessarily aggro quite the same number of things. So they've taken all three of those and made them a lot easier. Whereas the poor tortoise just sits in its corner waiting to be escorted all the way across the zone. it's odd that within this zone you've got one of the escort quests that's been made a lot easier, and then another one of them which is just as long and as dull as it's ever been. But yeah, it is worth it. If you haven't ever done it, I would strongly recommend doing it just because the reunion scene at the end is a work of genius.
Yeah, it's funny.
So yes, on that note, we probably should move on, leave Tenaris behind. Next, we are going to be, as Crashing mentioned just now, we're going to be moving on to Un'Goro Crater.
The sheer cliffs and dense overhead tree canopy set Un'Goro apart from the bleak regions it borders. Deep in the crater, a strange world remains apparently untouched by the passage of time outside. Ancient trees climb into the sky, and dinosaurs roam the ground and fill the air. The atmosphere in the crater is warm and humid. Hot springs and tar pits bubble and steam, and a volcanic vent brings lava to the surface in the heart of the region. The source of the crater's strange ecology is unknown. Perhaps it's tied to the huge crystal pylons mounted high on its sides. Perhaps it's simply an outcome of the volcanic conditions. But whatever the cause, the result is an oppressive land where unwary visitors may be taken unawares by giant devil saws whose approach is hidden by the mist.
The thing that always makes me laugh about Un'Goro Crater, and I mentioned something about this earlier, is it's like the pop culture nexus of Warcraft. I mean, I think of it as Nintendo Crater a lot of the time, because you've got so many quests that harken back to other games and other movies and stuff like that. I love it. It's this big, you know, jungle zone. I'm, for some reason, inclined to like jungle zones as it is. It's full of dinosaurs, which is fantastic. It's very, very atmospheric. Really, really like it. But like I said, it's got all these pop culture references, which make the quests in the zone that a lot more fun for some reason. You know, at this point, you're level 50-ish. You've been doing the whole kind of traditional, in its own, you know, Warcraft way, you know, go out, kill goblins quest, go out, do this. And so just a little tweak that the designers did where they bring in this other stuff. There's a whole bunch of quests that harken back to Nintendo games. You know, there's a reference to Link. There's a reference to Donkey Kong. There's a reference to Mario. There's references to movies like Chasing Amy. There's all sorts of stuff in this zone. It's just kind of a fun zone, I think. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think actually in a lot of ways the zone itself feels like a reference, not necessarily to pop culture, but to kind of slightly older cultural references. Because to me, the whole zone has a big Lost World feel about it.
Yeah, it's got the crystals and
It's got the dinosaurs. It's got everything about it just kind of screams this kind of, you know, all those classic old, you know, Lost World with the dinosaurs or whatever. It's interesting. I was talking with somebody in game about this a little while ago because we were talking about Sholazar Basin in Northrend, and I always, in my head, And this might mean absolutely nothing to half the people listening, but then again, everyone's geeks, so they'll probably pick it up. In my head, Shalazar Basin is the Savage Land from Marvel Comics, because right. It's this, you know, it's this tropical jungle in the middle of a frozen, wasteland.
Right.
And so, which is, you know, sort of maintained by some mysterious force, and in the Savage Land in the comics, it's one thing, and here it's in Shalazar, it's the Pillars. So I think of that one very much as the Savage Land, and I think of Angora Crater as the Lost World. Mm-hmm. You know, when dinosaurs, it's like it's dinosaurs, it's all that kind of stuff. It's a big jungly setting, and I think the whole thing feels like a setup that's taken from somewhere else, and then, as you say, they've just then layered in all these references.
Yeah, it's great too, because it's in the middle of, it's this lush green area in the middle of desert. Because we talking earlier, to get to it, you go through a desert, and then when you leave, you're back in a desert. Yeah. So it's great that it's so visually different. But yeah, like you were saying, the pop culture references that made me laugh. I remember the first time just as an example, there's a cave, it's got a bunch of gorillas in it. You kill a gorilla, and it has one of the gorillas, it's a random drop amongst the gorillas, it's like an empty keg, basically. You know, which is a Donkey Kong reference. And it took me like looting a couple of them before I got it. I'm like, what the hell is this thing for? And then after I'm like, oh, you know, it made me laugh out loud. So somebody was very clever in coming up with all the quest references.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think as the other thing about the zone that, as well as all those references, is that it's like you say, some of them you have to think about a little bit. Some of them they're not screamingly obvious. The character called Lincoln, who is kind of basically a play on Link, and has all of that kind of Nintendo stuff going on in the background, like you say, chasing Amy. It might take you a second to work it out, because even though the quest is called Chasing Amy, it's like the name of the thing is, you know, Amy. It's like, so they're kind of, they're there, and some of them are a bit more obvious than others, but some of them you actually do have to just take a moment. And like you say, you might have a moment where you're thinking, why are these apes dropping these? I don't understand. And then, the light goes on. It's like, oh, got it. Definitely. And again, as you were just saying, the fact that it is, you know, this kind of lush jungle space in between two desert zones, gives it a really distinctive feel, because you can you come from one extreme, which is one desert, and you come out of the other extreme, the other desert, and in the middle, it brilliantly, I think, does feel like you're in a big crater. You take the path down, and it's steep, and
if you can find it,
and the walls are, you know, the walls are anyway, you know, they're kind of they're pretty sheer. I mean, the number of times that I've been kind of skirting around the edge of one of the Silithid infestations in Tanaris, and you know, right on the edge, and just managed to misjudge it and fallen down a very, very long way into Angora Crater. I must have done that, you know, half a dozen times. So you know, it feels very cut off because of the kind of the sheer walls, how deep into, you know, below the regular ground level you've gone into this crater. The fact that in the middle there's the kind of
like a plateau, kind of ridge of volcanic stuff jutting out of the middle of it.
Exactly, and it's got all of that feel of being in
we
a
are not
crater.
Geologists.
Yeah, exactly. We are categorically not geologists. And there's the hot springs and stuff like that. So all of that kind of volcanic feel, you know, is definitely, I think, captured really effectively in the geography of the place.
Yeah, speaking to that, Velvet, when talking about it, says that while the overall feeling of Angora was that of a jungle, parts of the zone, such as the Fire Plume Ridge and the Golica Hot Springs, remind you there's also a site of an active volcano. Perhaps not as active as Black Rock Mountain, but the gigantic crater makes me think that Fire Plume Ridge is on the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You get a sense of something kind of bigger going on. And plus, it does. It still harkens back to like Land of the Lost, to the old, you know, King Kong movies, where there's, you know, jungle with dinosaurs and giant apes and volcanoes and everything else. Yeah. So it's a well-designed zone.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, the other thing that Velvet said was, as you write, his feeling was that this nails the jungle atmosphere more than even Stranglethorn Vale does. And he says, as you ride down into Un'Goro from Tanaris, you can see that there are absolutely massive ancient trees that form a high canopy and shade the ground. This is how jungles are. Imagine thousands upon thousands of plants in a single square mile, all trying to compete and struggle for the sunlight. As you can imagine, the floor of the jungle gets almost no light. The southeastern section of Un'Goro with the Ravasaurs conveys this setting well. And I think that's absolutely true. If you look at the height of some of the, given actually how deep the crater is, as I just said, some of the vegetation comes from the, from pretty much from the ground level, the lower ground level, to the top of the crater. Mm-hmm. If you look across the crater from Tanaris, say, you are looking at stuff that's only just to say below the level you're at, filling this crater. So the sense that it's been there for a long time and has been growing for a very long time is definitely, I think, conveyed really, really well.
So yeah. That's got devil sores. He mentioned the Ravasaurs. That's got the devil sore, which is one of your first probably encounters of a gigantic monster. You're not going to be able to kill by yourself anyway. That just kind of roams around wherever it feels like going, it seems like.
Yeah, and almost inevitably exactly where you are, and somehow you don't spot it until it's standing on you.
Exactly.
How many times? Just how many times? picking up a few other things that people from the guild said on the forum. Lachesis said that the stone is a personal favourite of mine. I stop into Un'Goro every chance I get. There's something primal and spooky and just plain cool about this place. I believe I've done every quest in the zone at least twice and I'm still not tired of it. As a matter of fact, when Cataclysm comes, one of the first things I'm going to do is take Lachesis out there and find myself a nice perch on a tree. If it still exists, I hope it will. it's interesting. I'm sure a lot of people have got an idea of what the first thing they're going to do when they're going to be able to fly in the old world is. And certainly, I mean, Lachesis is his druid, and like Arezzo is mine, there are certain things that I think will be more fun to do in flight form than necessarily on the back of a flying man. So I think I haven't quite decided what my first stop is going to be, but actually that one sounds quite appealing. stealing other people's ideas here, obviously. That's the entire purpose of this podcast, is just get ideas from other people. But his wrap-up to this, I think, is really interesting. I don't know what it is about this zone that enchants me so. The questing is pretty much the same as anywhere else. Kill this, collect that, escort the slowest NPC on Azeroth. It's like everyone thinks that...
Everyone has, yeah.
But there's something here that's lacking in places like Desolus, Tanaris, and Silithus. Oh, I know what it is. It's beauty.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is a pretty zone. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Like I said earlier, I've never been particularly into the desert zones in games like this. For some reason, for me, it just doesn't... you've got a tradition in science fiction and fantasy of desert-type, settings, dune and things like that. But for me, it's always, in my head, woods and jungles and things like that. And Un'Goro is a good example of the latter, jungle-type setting. So.
Yeah, definitely. And it's got... that, apart from the fact that it has got that kind of roaming dinosaur feel, and it's not just the devil sores, although obviously they're the big issue, but the pterodaxes are a living nightmare. They're pterodactyls that fear you, and then fear you into one of the other dinosaurs that's roaming around, or into the devil sore or whatever. So it is one of those zones where, even as you go around it at level, and even a few levels above, it's very, very easy to find yourself in a lot of trouble. And I think as any zone potentially has that, but a zone with dinosaurs roaming around in it probably ought to have that sense of danger more than some others, because they're dinosaurs.
Right, exactly.
But I think actually at level, I think a lot of the stuff in Un'Goro is pretty tough. Those gorillas we were talking about earlier on, they're hard. If you're leveling and
and they're in that cave too, so yeah. I mean they're all kind of bunched together.
Absolutely, and again it's that thing like you can go around a corner in the cave and suddenly you find yourself facing two of them, and they are tough. There's the kind of the big thunderers that are particularly hard, but all of them at level in that cave doing those quests, I think, are one of the toughest kind of areas for having to deal with the mobs that I can think of for kind of this sort of zone. Around the rest of it, yes, there's the devil swords, yes, there's the dinosaurs, yes, there's yet more silithids in the south of the zone, and yet more variations on the silithids, and just to kind of add more creepiness to the whole thing. But in some ways I actually think that cave with the gorillas is probably the toughest part of Un'Goro.
See, I think it's probably still the Scythalid area. Again, you got another area where you got, you know, those the Scythalid caves. You got to go down into them to do various and sundry things. It seems like there's even more of the bugs in this area than there were in the last area in terms of on the ground. It's an area, to be honest with you, when I'm leveling these days, I pretty much skip just because it's almost the results for the amount of time that it takes me, just for whatever reason, to drag through those quests that aren't, it doesn't work out, you know, because unfortunately now when you level, it's basically let's get through this as fast as we can so we can get to the good stuff towards the end, which is, really is unfortunate because there's a lot of really good stuff in some of these earlier zones.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good, the whole zone, I do like it. It's a zone I've always been fond of. Unlike some of the other ones that feel like they were sort of just put there to fill space, this feels like it has a purpose, if you will, that the zone has a story. They don't even necessarily get into the history of the zone that much when you're doing the quests even, but you feel like it's a place with history, and I like that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that when Gaffney and I first kind of started talking about this series, one of the things we wanted to do was to make sure that that all the various zones that people might now be rushing through, although obviously in an ideal world people will now stop and explore them a little bit more come the Cataclysm because they'll be different, but there is a sense I think that a lot of these zones now people just kind of power through, you know, whether it's just because, you know, they're on a mad dash to get to the end game, or whether it's simply because the mechanics of the game, whether it's heirlooms, whether it's the faster experience curve or what it is, but you know, whether it's simply being able to mount earlier and therefore get around quicker, any one of those things individually and potentially certainly all of them together make the process of getting through the old world a lot quicker than it used to be. And I think one of the things we wanted to make sure happened was that all of the zones, that even those that people are, you know, are likely to skip these days, you know, they got a little bit of a look in, that they all had an opportunity to be pointed out as someone's favorite, and I think every single zone is someone's favorite. So I'm glad that, you know, that where either because they're off the beaten track or they're not particularly useful for leveling now or whatever it is, that we are giving a bit of a chance to explore all of them. And I think the other thing that this one and Silithus in particular have going against them is their out of the wayness.
Yeah, they're not. You don't. You have to be going there.
Yeah, I mean,
there's not. You don't pass through there on the way to somewhere else.
Absolutely. I mean, Silithus is kind of the end of the line. You know, there's no way you can go further than it as well.
Right. In fact, on Crashing, I was recently doing those Halloween quests where you have to go to each one of the inns, and I realized I didn't have the inn. I didn't have the flight path to Silithus.
The flight path at Cenarion Hold, is that the one you mean?
That's what I'm looking for, yeah. I didn't have that at all, and so on that particular character. So yeah. I had to, you know, make the run, and then I didn't realize I couldn't find the path from... I knew about where it was, you know. It's like one of those deals where I know the path from Un'Goro to the other zone that I can't say.
Yeah.
Is here somewhere, and I can't find it. But just in leveling this character, I'd gone to Un'Goro, but I'd never had any reason to go further. Mm. And that's kind of a shame because there's a lot of cool stuff in a lot of these zones. So.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, on the Un'Goro front, before we start diverting completely into Silithus a little bit early, the other things, you know, as we talked about earlier on, Un'Goro is well known for gathering professions, herbs and mining in particular. Who was it? I think it was Lachesis. Yeah, Lachesis pointed out, for those inclined to farm, this is an excellent place for it. Herbs are plentiful here with Blindweed and Dreamfall near the tarpits, and most importantly, Mountain Silver Sage. All you have to do is run a few times around the edge of the zone and you've got bags overflowing with this valuable herb. Hint from Lachesis, farm yourself some to sell when Cataclysm releases. Assuming that there'll be any uses for it. And a lot of people, a couple of people mentioned on the thread, but I think everyone who is a miner knows as well that at a particular level, and again, in one of the patches, Blizzard significantly upped the likelihood of Mithril, I think it's Mithril, spawning, you know, the nodes there being being available. So it's one of those zones that I think became well known for its farming opportunities as much as for anything else.
It's Mithril and Thorium. It's one of the better places to get both of them,
there you
if
go.
I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think you're right. And actually, I might have been thinking about Thorium. But there you go. It's all metal. Metal. other couple of other things that I think are kind of worth noting. I mean, the zone does have those quests with the crystals and the pylons, which, you know, I guess are like the Un'Goro crater equivalent of the pillars in Chalazar Basin, the kind of the mysterious artifacts that seem to have something to do with the workings of the environment, but no, you know, you're not necessarily quite sure what, and you run around picking up all those crystals that just pack mm-hmm. your bags out as you go around the zone. But again, one of those little kind of, you know, references to the kind of stuff that you might find in other references to lost worlds with jungles and dinosaurs in them, you know, the kind of the mysterious artifact that seems somehow tied to how this place can even exist is there. And I think the other thing to kind of, from my point of view, that is kind of worth kind of just mentioning in passing is obviously, and again, it's a quest that was added to the game a long time after people were leveling through this area in vanilla, but is the opportunity to get a mount in the zone, which is, you know, which is the Ravasaur mount, which is one of those quests, well, rather one of those chains or one of those endeavors in the game that just takes forever. 20 days of doing that daily in a part of the world that is very disconnected from anywhere else in the world, and that means you have to keep going back there day after day after day.
Right. It's one of those time sink quests, yeah. Which wouldn't be too bad if you could get there easily.
Yes.
But since you can't, it's even more of a time sink.
Absolutely. And you know, and some of the quests mean that you've got to go back into Tanaris, and some of them you do in Un'Goro. But I remember the day. I'm so obvious. It's quite tragic. The day that was patched into the game, I was there, and Gaffoni was there, and a whole bunch of other people from the guild were there, all trying to do the first stuff to kick that that thread off, so that we could get our, you know, so we could get our new mounts.
I was there until I realized that I'm a troll and I basically ride around on a dinosaur anyway. So I'm like, well, no, well, I'm not going to spend 2 weeks doing this.
Well, you know, I even to this day, I mean, my preferred mount on Arezzo is in fact a troll mount, because I really like those mounts. But and I could have not bothered at all, really, because sooner or later I was going to get exalted with the trolls and I was going to be able to get one. But it's one of those things. It's like it was put in the game. It's new. It's different. It's unusual. We must do it. We must do it. We are like drones.
I wonder how many psychologists work for Blizzard. I mean, honestly, it's got to be a couple. You know, it really does.
What can we throw it? What will they respond to? What will this obsessive compulsive audience that we appear to be talking to respond well to next? So yeah,
I am. Oh, and before we move on, sure. One reason I love Un'Goro is that it's how I made my nest egg for my first character. For a while, there was was it a Ravasaur brood mother or something like that? It was a rare spawn. She spawned maybe once or twice a day at the most, and she dropped a rare pet. And I discovered it by accident right after, I guess, they put it into the game and managed to get two or three of them. So all of, you know, and that was a couple characters ago, to be honest with you. But my characters to this day owe a debt of gratitude to that one particular mob that dropped that one particular pet that would sell for, you know, a couple thousand gold at the time.
Yeah.
So that's another reason I look at it fondly. I can afford to buy things now basically because of it.
Fair enough. Just one last comment that was made on the thread about the area from Tandoro again. Un'Goro is the zone that teaches you to watch out for the giant thing that can randomly show up to squish you. I think, as we mentioned, we're all familiar with that one. He also points out, especially back in the old days, I never did find out why people wanted so much dirt from there. I'd leave before I finished the quest. That, for anyone who isn't familiar with it, is a reference to a quest which is available both to Horde and Alliance, but from completely different places outside of the zone, rather than being local, but you need to come here to do it, which is the Morrowgrain quests, to gather Un'Goro dirt and mix it with some seeds and grow a herb and potentially gather a particular thing that is needed. But yeah, the kind of the piles of Un'Goro dirt around the place that you see as you're running around and people kind of digging up the dirt. It is one of those things you kind of wonder, if I didn't know what was going on, I would be very confused as to the fact that I was able to interact with just piles of dirt, basically.
I always assumed that dirt was a euphemism You know, it's another one of these, you know,
but, you know, they're not
poop gathering quests that
they're
you have.
Not usually what? Shy in the rest of the game. I think
that's true.
I like to think that this actually might be dirt. I could be completely wrong, but I choose to think so because I've scrabbled around in quite a lot of it over the years. Anyway, that is, I think, Un'Goro Crater. One thing I will say is
that's Un'Goro Crater. Yeah, lots of dinosaurs and up to your, you know,
exactly up to your whatever
elbows and poop.
Maybe it's dinosaur. No, I won't go there. But that is Un'Goro Crater, and I think one thing I will say is, as occasionally happens on these shows, on the thread, people wrote a lot about all of these zones. There are some essays on that thread that I think, you know, we haven't been able to kind of include all of it because you would just be bored, rigid, hearing me read paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of somebody else's words, but do check the thread out on the AIE forums, because a lot of people had a lot to say, and definitely, you know, as we were saying, each person seems to have a kind of passionate feeling about one or other or more than one of these zones, so do check that out. But having talked a little bit about Un'Goro registered already that there is one very logical next place to go on from there. Let us do exactly that and take the long winding path up the western side of the crater to Silithus.
To the first time visitor to Silithus, it feels like every surface and the very air itself is infested by the insect swarms whose buzzing fills the air. In every corner of the region, the Silithid presence is felt, even around the towers of the hold from which the druids of the Cenarian Circle and their allies stand watch. The last vestige of the Kiraji Empire has forever tainted this land, bringing ruin to the Night Elf outposts and rendering this most remote part of Kalimdor desolate and bleak. The vast gates of Ankaraj itself guard the ancient secrets of the Insect Empire, while encampments of twilight cultists and the recent return of the bronze dragonfly to the region may be harbingers of future conflict.
Now, when we were talking about Tanaris earlier on, and I was saying about, you know, the kind of the creepiness of the twitchy legs on the Silithid hives, that was bad enough. Nothing could have prepared me for the swarms of insects flying around every construction of any kind, every building, every mound, every old ruin, everything in Silithus. Silithus is just, if you had a serious insect phobia, I can only imagine that just the very sight of Silithus when you first enter it would get your skin crawling, because it practically does that for me. And I don't particularly mind bugs that much, but it's like bugs to the max. And I think that's just the defining thing that you get out of it. You know, everywhere you look, there's even the ones that are just kind of so high up on the top of buildings you can't interact with them. You know, you just see them. It's constant movement in the air. And the idea that this is a really desolate last point on the road outpost that has been invaded by these alien insect creatures that are absolutely everywhere is incredibly effective, I think, in this zone.
Yeah, you mentioned the swarms. I mean, the zone literally has swarms of bugs up in the air flying around. And I remember the first time I walked into the zone, this was some time ago, obviously, but you walk in and you can see it. They're just swarming around anything that has any height to it at all. And my first thought was, oh my God, that's not gonna come after me, right?
I mean,
that's
not gonna like the same.
Yeah, and so it's very, from an atmospheric standpoint, yeah. That is a great design thing, because you can see them. I mean, they're obviously way far off in the distance, but you can see this just black cloud of insects flying around, and yeah. That sets the tone right there for what you're going to be in for the whole time.
Absolutely, and the sound as well. The sound of them is everywhere, which is in some ways is almost worse, because you know it's totally omnipresent and it feels like it is right next to you. Even like you say, even the things that don't interact with you, that are way up, that are effectively just kind of color in the right. in the visual landscape, they're kind of, there's the auditory landscape just has this sound which just follows you around, and it gets under your skin and it's just there all the time. I think in terms of a zone that manages to insinuate itself into your senses, I think Silithus is right up there with the best of them.
Yeah, I don't play with headphones, but I imagine if you play wearing headphones, I would just be like scratching the whole time, you know, like itching and swatting invisible things by your head and everything else.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it. I don't play with headphones either, but yeah, I think if I ever was, I would probably have to take them off.
For the
joys of Silithus. So yes, it's one of those zones. In fact, I would say definitively it is the zone that most effectively conveys, you know, a sense of creeping wrongness through both the visuals and the audio. It's also a zone that, as we've said kind of two or three times during the course of this discussion, is absolutely at the end of the line. There is nothing beyond Silithus. There is one way in, there is one way out. On the ground, obviously, you can fly in and out, but there is one way in, there is one way out. There is nothing beyond it. There is the sea, obviously, but you can't, you know, it's kind of somewhere over behind the land, and it's just this amazingly end of the line kind of feeling to it, and the Cenarian hold, which somehow, you know, is like proper full blown night elf architecture in the middle of this zone, which clearly is a holdover from the days when it wasn't quite like it is, because, you know, in other parts of the zone as well, there are kind of night elf ruins. So you can kind of see that there's been a history here, that once upon a time, this is one of those zones that hasn't always been like it is now. But there's something about the way the Cenarian hold just stands there, this kind of incredibly tall, incredibly somehow, you know, still sort of solid set of structures in the middle of the zone is incredibly impressive to ride up to that very first time.
It is, and the funny thing it does from a story standpoint, at least for me, is I understand that they're NPCs and they're not actual human beings or they're not actual sentient creatures and stuff, but for some reason the Centurion Circle men and women who are stationed at Centurion Hold, you know, I always think, man, you guys, this is not if you're a young druid and you sign up to be in the Centurion Circle and you're all excited and they're like, oh, guess what? Your first assignment is going to be way out in Syphilis. And you're like, oh, God, no, why? You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
We are on the out, the end of the earth, and it is the nastiest place. And I thought, you know, every time I go there, it kind of makes me chuckle because I think, man, who did you guys make mad to get this assignment?
Exactly. And who do I have to sleep with to get out of it?
Exactly.
It is like that. It definitely feels like, you know, that it is the last place in the world you would want to be sent to. It is the last place in the world, and it is the last place in the world you'd want to be sent to. And that outpost, you know, it's called a hold. It is absolutely like a bastion. It is like the outpost at the end of the world. It's got terrible, terrible stuff all around it. You know, whether it's not just the Silithids, I should say, but all the other stuff that is in that zone. You know, the kind of those great big worm things that are everywhere. There are spiders, there are scorpions. It's, you know, it's totally inhospitable. There are
even the humans that are there are nasty.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, you know, there's elementals in various places. The as you say, the cultists who occupy large parts of the place, like they've got, you know, three fairly substantial camps there. You know, they're twilight cultists. They're bad people. We know that these are bad people. We've seen them being bad in various parts of the world, and they will continue to be bad going forward, as we also know. There's something about this place that just definitely feels like this is just the worst. This is it. End of the line. Just don't even think about going any further, because there is no further to go.
Everything alive there, it seems like its whole job is to kill you.
Yeah.
And it's made even worse by the fact that it's a PvP zone. I mean, to a certain extent, it's got like in-world PvP. So I imagine especially during the height of vanilla, I imagine it was crowded. And I imagine there's a lot of even if you weren't on a PvP server, there was a lot of in-game PvP going on. So it's like the most dangerous zone in vanilla, where, you know, the water will kill you, basically. It's like everything's going to kill you.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit upset, not upset, but I look back at it now, because every time I was in the zone, I was basically the only person there. A whole lot of the time, because it is very abandoned most of the time now. And I kind of wish that I'd been around during vanilla when it was jumping, because I bet it was a lot of fun. All of the PvP quests, or most of them, are of the type where you need more than just one person working by themselves in order to really affect any sort of change, such as it is in the zone. You need 10 people collecting that stuff on the ground and hauling it off and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. Actually, I did level through it in vanilla, and it is totally Final Frontier-ish. It was the place that everybody went to, because it was, you know, it was that was the it was the pinnacle. It was like that and the Plaguelands basically were you know your end game leveling. And in fact, one of the comments on the thread from Velvet was about that. He says, back in vanilla, Silithus was to me a very much off-limits zone. On my PvP server, I mean, can you imagine it with the PvP anyway, but also on a PvP server? It was to high-level players what Stranglethorn Vale was to low-level players. The people who went to Silithus were the hardcore and well-geared, while the elite neutral guards made sure little to no PvP happened in town. The path between Cenarion Hold and Ankiraj was well travelled by high-end raiders, who also happened to have the edge in PvP back then. A guildless player or a player in a casual raiding guild that would never see beyond Zul'Gurub or Molten Core had no business in Silithus. And I think that is absolutely the way it used to be. I mean, I was on a PvE server when I was leveling through there, and it wasn't quite that bad, but it was well travelled by very high level players on both sides, and it, you know, especially once Ankiraj opened, or once the event leading up to the opening of the gates of Ankiraj was happening, you know, it became a big focus of a lot of people's attention, and a lot of people at very high levels. I mean, I was not able to be around the day that the gates of Ankiraj were opened on the server that I was on at that time, but I'm sure it was phenomenal and amazing. But at the same time, you know, it did at that point feel like a continuation of the way that zone was. And as you say, these days it's pretty desolate in terms of how many players there are there.
Could you talk a little bit about Ankiraj? Because I wasn't around at the time, and it sounds like it was a kind of a fantastic event for everybody involved, just the build up to it and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that has never been done in the game, the like of which has never been done in the game since. Essentially, there was a quest chain that one person on each server would receive the item that would kick it off, and then essentially, although the rest of the server could kind of be involved, because there were a series of support quests which were all about providing material to your faction that would help with the kind of the war effort, basically with mm-hmm. the Queen War. So you could donate cloth to be made into bandages. You could donate ore. You could donate, you know. So you kind of and the point was that until a certain amount of material was donated across the world, the next stages wouldn't happen. So essentially, in order to kind of get to the point where the gates of Ankiraj would open on your server, you know, everybody who was interested in seeing that happen would chip in. Everyone was like gathering and turning stuff in, and gathering and turning stuff in. So there was this sense of like everybody had this anticipation. And then the specific quest chain that led to the opening of the gates was basically something that you had to do with your guild. And on each server, the kind of the person and the player and the guild that were going to be opening the gates, you know, suddenly became the focus of all the attention.
Like the entire world is focused on this one guy, one player, basically.
It was like that. It lasted for a period of time. Obviously, on every server, the gates opened at a different time, because the amount of time it would take, you know, you didn't know when somebody was going to be able to start down that quest chain. You didn't know how quickly each server's population would gather the materials. So basically, each server, the gates opened on a different day at a different time. And the kind of the sense of this being a world event really happened. It really existed. It felt like something that the entire, you know, it's one of those things like the eyes of the world are on us today. It was like that. It was quite
that
phenomenal.
Must have been an amazing thing if you were that one player too. I mean, in these games, you're always, you know, you always want to feel like you're the hero, but you're obviously not, because you'll kill some whatever, and the Lich King will be back again tomorrow, kids, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
But in this particular case, that's not how it was. Yeah. I mean, how do they determine who the one player was?
I think it was, there was an item that dropped, and it would drop once in the world, and the person who dropped it was how it started. I think that's how it worked.
I mean, what if you didn't know what it was? And you're just like, oh, that's destroy it. Oh,
exactly. It was quite amazing. And then the event itself, the opening of the gates, wasn't a 5 second, right now the gates are open, everyone could go into Ankiraj. There was a huge event that went on around it that went on for hours and hours, and people could come into it. There was a battle, and people could come and join it, and it was huge. And there really has not been anything like it in the game since. And so, you know, on an individual level, they've kind of got around the fact that there hasn't been anything like that with kind of phased content. So, you know, spoilers, boys and girls, the Battle of the Wrathgate and the you know retaking of Undercity quest chain in Northrend, that's kind of got the same sort of flavour to it, although it's on a smaller scale and obviously it happens in that kind of phased way. So now you could almost see how they've gone away from the idea that there might be a single huge thing that the whole server needs to experience at the same time to a phased thing that everybody can experience at their own rate, which at least means you're not going to miss it.
Because right. Like, I understand like I say, you know,
and if you, and it did have the disadvantage that if you couldn't be online on that particular day, you would miss it on your server. But also, if you joined a server after the gate, after its gates of Anchorage had opened, then you missed all the excitement anyway. So. Right. The kind of the phase thing does have its advantages, but it doesn't have that sense of, you know, every single person in the world is potentially part of this process and this experience, which, yeah, is... I wasn't in any way intending to spend as long talking about this, but I'm quite glad that I have, actually, because it's kind of reignited a certain amount of excitement that I had about that at the time. It's quite cool. It's very cool.
Like I said, I wasn't around at the time, but I've heard... You know, people speak of it in whispers. No, I mean, I've heard people talking about it since then, but a lot of times you just like, don't know what you're talking about. So that's interesting. It would be interesting to see something like that again, but I really do think the player base would throw a fit if they did something like that now, just the way the player base is in general.
I think
and so the phasing stuff is probably for the best.
Yes, that's probably true. What else did people say about it? So that was Velvet's point. About Silithus and PvP and stuff like that, and he goes on to say, even in the present, there's still little reason to go to Silithus outside of the Anchorage raids. There's a bloat of low 50s quests in other zones that will likely carry you to 58 without even visiting this zone at all, which I guess is probably what happened to you.
That's exactly what happened.
Also, there's the fact that this is probably the most out of the way zone in the whole game when compared to where the major cities are located. So again, it's that end of the line thing. I think, you know, we've kind of, having discussed that end of the lineness and how far away from everything it is and how remote it all feels and how out on your own you are, it probably is worth kind of having a quick look at some of the things that you can do when you're in Silithus. We mentioned the Twilight Cult cultists in various places, and I, not that long ago, actually it feels like not that long ago, it's probably about a year ago, heaven help me, was back in Silithus for quite a lot of time because I was working on my Cenarion rep, because I wanted to get my Guardian of Cenarius title, which involves you getting Cenarion Circle rep and Cenarion Expedition rep up to Exalted in both cases. And the only way beyond a certain point to work on your Cenarion Circle rep is to go to Silithus and kill many, 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 many Twilight cultists. I mean, really, really many of them. And get their Twilight cultist outfits and put it on and deal with the elementals that you can summon. And
that's cool. I mean, that particular part of it is cool, which is kind of more unique.
Yeah.
In that, and somebody mentioned it too, there is the Twilight Cult quests where you basically have to gather their outfit and you put the outfit on and pretend to be one of them for a while.
Yeah.
Which is, that's a neat mechanic. That's a neat game mechanic.
Yes. It's like you can only summon the elemental if you look like one of the cultists who the elementals, you know, will respond to.
Right. Which is funny if you think about it, because it's an elemental, you're not going to... But, you know, yeah, okay, exactly. Whatever.
It's like, yes, I recognize your clothes. I shall materialize on your earthly plane, or Azerothian plane. It is these days, I think, is one of the things that takes people at higher levels back to Silithus is that rep grind. But at level, again, the difference between going back and doing something and doing it at level, it's quite tough. There are a lot of cultists in those camps. You don't get the relevant items to drop from every mob. A bunch of them patrol. A bunch of them have kind of pets, minions, that kind of stuff. So it's quite hard. And each camp has a higher level kind of overseer, which there is a quest to kill each of them. But also they respawn really, really quickly. So the quests around those camps and the whole Twilight Cult line of activity was, you know, it could occupy you quite solidly. In fact, probably the thing that would occupy you the most solidly is there are three pieces in the Twilight Cultist's outfit that you needed to get. And what would tend to happen is you'd find yourself with like nine of one of them and like one each of the other two. And you needed a whole set each time you were going to go to one of the summoning stones and summon the elemental and deal with it.
Because summoning elementals is hell on your clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it really is. You can never get it. Doesn't matter how many times you send it out, you can't get that smell out.
I know, it's just horrible. Yeah. So that's one of the things. But it is one of those elements in the no pun intended in the zone that I think people are probably rediscovering Silithus for, which is that specific Cenarian rep grind.
Yeah, especially now when people have a little bit of time on their hands and they're going back and doing some of those cool things they maybe didn't do the first time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. It points up the difference, I think, between kind of expansion rep grinds and old world rep grinds. Because actually, I hit Exalted with Cenarian Expedition, who kind of start off in Zangarmarsh in Outland and then kind of reappear in Northrend. I hit Exalted with them really quickly, almost without even registering I was doing it. I don't think I actually actively went out and ground that much rep for them. I think it might literally have been, you know, maybe 10 or 20 turn-ins of Nessingwary Hunter Ears in Northrend got me there.
Well, plus two, the instances in Wrath.
Yeah.
Give various and sundry, you know, rep for the different groups, so you can do. You're right. You can do it almost without meaning to.
And likewise in Burning Crusade.
Burning Crusade.
I mean, same thing. You know, there's ways to do that. Whereas in the old world, they were all, you know, to get to Exalted with practically anybody was just a grind. And I think that kind of points up the difference between not just the way that the world design has changed as the expansions have come along, but also the way things like rep have been. Have changed in their mechanic and the way that players have to approach them have changed over time. I mean, ages ago, but way back in one of the earlier episodes, Gaffoni and I were talking about how the Ghostlands, which was obviously introduced with Burning Crusade, introduced people to the idea of rep much earlier because of the Tranquillian quest chain. That, you know, that change to the way rep was managed, was handled, and also that introduction to it earlier on, I think is very indicative of that movement over time as far as the rep mechanics were concerned. The scenario stuff in Silithus is definitely old school. The other things in the zone, you know, we talked a bit about the insects, but they are everywhere.
Yep.
And not in a good way. The particular quest that I really remember is, or the chain that I really remember is the one that starts at Cenarion Hold and involves the female night elf who has basically gone mad and had kind of gone almost voluntarily into one of the Silithus hives, and you know, you're sent in to find out what happened to her, and you have to talk to the dwarves who may have seen her, and it's almost like a little follow the detective story.
I remember that. I did that on my warlock, and I'd forgotten about it until you mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the end being kind of creepy.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Yes, because she's basically kind of, essentially she's been possessed by the Silithid.
Yeah.
Sort of presence. But yeah, there is that whole thing of like go and talk to the dwarves and see if they've seen her, see if they know where she might have gone. There's a sense of following a trail, which is kind of quite nice in that quest chain. And then there is Ankiraj, which, you know, is now essentially just a kind of big complex in the desert with two raid instances in it. But which obviously at one point just used to basically be a great big gateway that, you know, you couldn't go through. It was just this, and in a lot of ways that actually was, to use a phrase I've overused a lot in the last kind of 15 minutes or so, that really was the end of the world. It's like, well, where do you go beyond there? Well, nowhere, because you can't get past the gates. So that was that was it. Bye. And I turn around and go back.
Now, when that raid instance finally opened, was that the kind of the top of the line, very end of the world?
Yes.
Is that the last raid before the expansion?
Hang on, let me get this right. It was that and Naxxramas were the two.
That's right. I forgot Nax used to be.
Yeah, were the two kind of old world top end raids, and I forget which one was actually the hardest. because obviously, I mean, in a sense, it's like I say, there's almost, in the same way as there's two different directions to in the old world to in vanilla to level at the very to the very top levels. It was either you came down to Silithus in Kalimdor, or in the Eastern Kingdoms, you went to the Plague Lands, and you went Western Plague Lands, Eastern Plague Lands, and obviously Naxxramas used to be in Eastern Plague Lands, and Silithus had Ankh-Iraj, and they were both in that, you know, like I say, one of them was probably the top one, and I have a feeling the last one that was introduced was actually Naxxramas, because a lot of the reason why that was given for moving Naxxramas to Northrend was because not a lot of people really experienced Naxxramas, because it used to be the top end raid in vanilla, and also it was introduced quite late. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of time for people to experience it before everyone moved on to Outland when Burning Crusade was launched. So, but they were right up there at the top. And Ankh-Iraj is still, actually, even with, you know, kind of a decently leveled, the harder of the two Ankh-Iraj raids is actually still quite tough. There's one fight in particular that you really need a big group to get through. I mean, there's a sense that now you can kind of take a group of, you know, 10 people and into any old raid in the old world and just, you know, and just wipe the floor with it. But actually, not true as far as Ankh-Iraj is concerned. So
interesting.
It's interesting because that we have ended up talking so much about it because. For a long time, there was nothing there, and now it's almost become the defining feature of the zone.
Mm-hmm. It is. It really is. I mean, even if you don't go into it, a lot of the quests also point towards it in one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the quests do take you into it. There are quests within. There's a whole series of quests that now, you know, I'm not sure how many people actually take the time to do them because they don't count for Lore Master. But they are specifically, they relate to a series of weapons that you can get from within the Ankh-Iraj raids. Within the Ankh-Iraj raids, and which, you know, like I say, you'd have to kind of be a bit of a completist, I think, to do them. But yeah, there are a whole bunch of things that kick off at Cenarion Hold that point directly into Ankh-Iraj.
I think the kind of one person made a comment which reflects sort of what we said about a bunch of these zones, but specifically this one. It was Tondoro, and he just said, "Syphilis gives me the creeps. I can't stay there. It's by far the most disturbingly creepy place in WoW, in my opinion." And I certainly think that's probably true of the old world. So I have to agree with him there.
I think that, as a sentiment, I think that's probably quite a good one to wrap the look at Syphilis up with, because, you know, really, what more needs to be said? So we're almost at the end of this episode. We are going to do one quick last visit. Earlier in the series, we looked at most of the Horde cities. The one that we haven't looked at yet, which we're just going to talk about now since we're in Kalimdor for this episode, is the last of the four, which is Thunderbluff, the Tauren capital city, which I feel particular affinity for because 90% of all characters I've ever played on the Horde side have been Tauren. Don't ask me why, it's just a thing. But I'm very, very fond of Thunderbluff. Is it one you spend a lot of time in?
I love Thunderbluff. It's probably it's tied for first place in my favorite Horde cities. It's that or the Undercity. Just the Undercity's so atmospheric, but Thunderbluff, I have a great affinity for it too. I'm also a big Tauren fan. I don't know why I started to troll Shaman when I could have done the Tauren. I think because I had a bunch of other Tauren characters, I wanted to see the troll side of it. But I think Thunderbluff is the most interestingly designed city on the Horde side. It's just such a great visual. It's laid out so interestingly. It's very convenient, actually, the way it's set up. I love the history and the you get a real sense of culture, I think, traveling around Thunderbluff. You learn what the Tauren are about by hanging out in the city, and that just I think speaks really, really highly of the whole design of the place.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the things that we commented about in the earlier episodes a lot about the Horde cities is that compared to most of the Alliance cities, I've always traditionally found the Horde cities quite confusing in layout terms and stuff like that. And Thunderbluff does not escape that. That whole, which level do I come out of the flight path tower on? And, you know, if I hang on, I'll be halfway across a bridge to one of the other kind of, you know, peaks and realize that actually I'm going towards a different one than I thought I was going to. And even to this day, I still will find myself doing that. So I think
the thing that annoys me about that tower is it kills your, if you're in a, you know, travel form, or if you're on your mount or whatever, it knocks you off. I hate that. It's a slight annoyance, you know, but I'm like, oh man, I'm running up the, damn it.
Yeah.
They do the same thing in Orgrimmar, but it's more pronounced because in Thunderbluff, you've got to go up and down that tower to get anywhere.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that just slightly undermines my enjoyment of it. But otherwise, I think it's a great city. I love that it feels very open, and, you know, it is part of it. It's kind of, it's not built up in the way that, say, Orgrimmar is. It feels very much like it's just a settlement that is as natural as it can be in the context of, you know, of the Tauren and Mulgore and the, you know, that the whole feeling of the zone that it sits in. I think it's useful. I mean, this is kind of slightly shaming, but the major reason that I spend time there these days is because my Bankolt is there. And, you know, I think it's a great place for a Bankolt. It's like the mailbox, the bank, and the auction house are really close together. So yeah, it has its advantages from that point of view in terms of how that area is organized. Although, if you also want to get out and find a trainer or a, you know, class trainer or a profession trainer or whatever, you can find it getting a little confusing across the different rises. But yeah, I really, really like Thunderbluff, not just because of the Tauren in me, but because I just really think it is the nicest of the Horde cities.
It is, and it's, and like I said, visually it is so striking, especially if you're starting a new character. Starting a Tauren, and you've been to little Tauren cities there, you know, little outlying towns for a bit, and you do that run in, and all of a sudden it sort of looms in front of you, you know, and it's way up on the mesas or whatever you call it. We are not geologists. The bluffs, I guess. The bluffs. The it's just a great, great looking city. I love the architecture. I love, you know, like I said, I love the story. I love how the designers have done little things in the game to make you understand who the people are and what the history of the area is. And Blizzard does an excellent job of that. And I think Thunderbluff, along with Undercity, they're the two cities in the game, really, where you get the best feeling for that. You get the feeling for who the race is by their city. So yeah. I'm a fan.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun just to run around and just interact with the NPCs there, I think, and you know, Cairn up there at the back in his kind of big hut, is just such a fantastic figure to kind of approach. And I honestly find myself RPing in Thunderbluff again, probably because of the whole Tauren thing, but more so than anywhere else in the game. You know, if for any reason on any character, you know, there's a bunch of quests where you actually have to go and interact with Cairn, I will absolutely always approach him at a walk. I will always kneel my character in front of him. You know, it's like there's something about his standing in that city, in that town, and the kind of his place in that community that I just think almost commands it in me, which is really unusual because I'm not at heart much of an RPer when it comes to a game like Warcraft. So
I think that that speaks to what a good job the designers did in giving you a sense of culture, the culture of the place. Yeah. And I'm sort of the same way, to be honest with you. You know, you see Thrall all the time, and the first time you see Thrall, it's kind of cool, it's very cool, and you interact with him a little bit, but after a while it's just kind of background. But you know, you feel like you're right, he has kind of a weight to him, if you will. Mr. Bloodhoof does. And so I like the city. I really do. Now I'm wishing that I made crashing a Tauren. Now that we're talking about it, the more we're talking about it, the more I'm like, why did I do that?
Why
did I break with tradition?
Well, at the very first opportunity, i.e. as soon as Cataclysm drops, I am going to be converting Batchy, because I will be able to have a Tauren priest at long last, and that'd be like, yes,
very nice.
At last. So yes, lots of love here clearly for Thunderbluff. So that's been a little tour of various points in Kalimdor, Tanaris, or Tanaris, bless you, Beira, Un'Goro Crater and Silithus, and Thunderbluff. So next time, with a slightly warmer atmosphere in the place, we're going to be over back in the Eastern Kingdoms, looking at Searing Gorge, Burning Steps, and all that is in and around Blackrock Spire. Or Blackrock Mountain, I should say. So that will be, there'll be a thread on the forum as usual for contributions, thoughts, ideas of things not to miss, and anything anybody else wants to say about Searing Gorge and Burning Steps. We will be back very, very soon. We're trying to wrap these last few shows up before the Cataclysm hits, for obvious reasons. So hopefully that one will be out within this next 4 or 5 days. And in the meantime, thank you to everyone who contributed to this show's forum thread, and hope you'll have things to say again next time. Thank you to Gaffoni for chipping in his bits. Thank you to Crashing. Thank you very much indeed.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. Thank you to one and all for listening. We will be back very, very soon with episode 10. The end is in sight. And in the meantime, goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
We'll see you soon.